Okay, shall we start? My goal is to try to do several different things at once today, which is always a bad idea in all walks of life, including philosophy, but I'm going to try it anyways. One thing I want to do is transfer our attention from philosophy of mind and external world, cases of skepticism, which we've mostly been talking about, to philosophy of language, and see how parallel issues come up in the philosophy of language. So that's one goal, is to just shift the area, but see in some detail what it looks like in philosophy of language. But another thing I wanted to do today is also start to explore how it is that somebody could think what we saw John McDowell saying at the end of our last class. Well, I'm sorry, at the end of the last class I was here for, last Wednesday. At the end of that class, we saw McDowell arguing that Cartesian problems about knowledge, this is particularly clear in section 3 of the Introduction to Mind and World, but it's throughout his writing. The Cartesian problems about knowledge, certainty, doubt, are inchoate and inept expressions of a deeper philosophical anxiety, which, when it becomes fully self-conscious, and to borrow a phrase from Wittgenstein, strictly thought through to its end, takes the form of, to borrow a phrase from me, a Kantian skeptical problem. So, that's something McDowell thinks, I think. He thinks if you start with a Cartesian problem in some area of philosophy, and you really think through what your commitments are there, it will bottom out into something that then takes the shape of a Kantian problem. That's a big claim, but we might want to see how it is in philosophy of language that might happen, because I think Kripke thinks something like that about philosophy of language, or at least came to by the time he was finished writing his book, came to start to think something like that. Or at least, if that's too much to say about Kripke, Kripke gives you the materials for drawing such a conclusion. So it'd be an instance of that. We'll look at others in our last couple of classes. But so that's a second thing I'm interested in doing in this class within the framework of philosophy of language, is exploring the relationship between Cartesian and Kantian skepticism. A third thing I'm interested in today is how a lack of clarity about what our problem is, whether we're putting in a Cartesian or a Kantian frame, itself can lead to confusion. And a fourth topic, which I'm mostly preparing the way for today, but which we'll talk about next time, is what happens when philosophers who are writing about skepticism comment and criticize each other. So next time we'll be looking at Cavell's criticisms of Kripke. And part of what I want to suggest next class, I'll say this right now, take the surprise out of it, what I want to suggest next class is that Cavell and Kripke don't obviously disagree about anything having to do with, actually it's very hard to know how to put this. I'll just put it much more cautiously, I'm sorry. It's not clear what Cavell and Kripke disagree about, I'll put it that way. And it's not clear that Cavell and Kripke have the disagreement that Cavell takes himself to have with Kripke. And so this will help bring out how hard it is to just move from one author writing about skepticism to another. That's part of what I want to prepare in our investigation of Kripke today. So I'm doing four things today. Now, Kripke's book is kind of a tricky book in ways that matter. This and his article. There's a book and an article here. I'm trying to talk about both at once. One reason they're tricky is because they're not officially giving you Kripke's views about anything. We'll come back to that in the last quotation on the handout. Look more carefully at what he says. But Kripke's official stance is that he's trying to give us Wittgenstein's views. But then he thinks there's various problems about giving us Wittgenstein's views. One of which is that the problem itself has a character where it's not easy to say what the problem is, which he thinks is part of the problem itself, for reasons we'll also look into. Second is Wittgenstein famously said he didn't have any views, which makes it hard to say what his views are if Wittgenstein was right about that. I've sort of simplified a big topic here. But for all of these reasons, Kripke once says that what he's doing is not giving us Kripke's views, and he's not prepared to just say what he's doing is giving us something like Wittgenstein's views. Rather, what he wants to discuss above all is a particular philosophical problem. And then a solution he takes himself to be able to find in Wittgenstein's writings, maybe rightly or maybe wrongly. And so what he's giving is Wittgenstein and the problem that Wittgenstein seemed to be making urgent as it struck Kripke when he read Wittgenstein. So that's what we're talking about. It's actually our object of investigation. Hilary Putnam has suggested a name for whose ideas we're discussing then, which is Kripkenstein. Kripkenstein, and that's the word I will sometimes use today when I'm discussing something that clearly seems to only properly be attributable at most to Kripkenstein, as opposed to either Kripke or Wittgenstein. Why it is that one has to look all the way to Kripkenstein, that is, to a philosopher who in some sense never existed, in order to find what comes to clear expression in Kripke's book about Kripkenstein is itself, I think, an interesting issue, which we might discuss at the end of today. But before we look at Kripkenstein, it might be a good idea to look for a moment at Wittgenstein, because ostensibly these things come out of Wittgenstein. So that's what I want to do first. On the first page of your handout, I've just given you again an attempt to summarize, by way of a reminder, what one might take to be a kind of Cartesian version of a skeptical problem, as it can arise in philosophy of language. Tried to structure this in a way that's obviously parallel to the cases we saw in external world skepticism, other mind skepticism, philosophy of action, and so forth, and then a Kantian variety of the problem, again, parallel to the other sorts we've looked at. I won't bother to go through this. I take this to be repetition at this point. But that might be helpful to have on the page as we're looking at these various quotations, first from Wittgenstein and Kripkenstein. Because one question we might have is, what kind of problem is this that's in these quotations? Is it of this sort, or is it of this sort, or neither, or both? It's a question I want to have in your mind. Now, what I've done with these Wittgenstein quotations, there's just six here, is almost exclusively, all I've done is given you some of the bits of the text that Kripke fixates on in order to generate his reading of Wittgenstein. So I purposely, that's one of the reasons I've been scrupulous enough to put a dot, dot, dot before and after my quotations. These passages are just lifted out of Wittgenstein. If you read around the bits I've lifted, then you might start worrying about Kripke's overall interpretation of Wittgenstein. You might in particular start worrying about the supposed skeptical solution he attributes to Wittgenstein. Well, that's what Wittgenstein's after. But my aim today is not Wittgenstein interpretation. I'm not out to convince you he's right or wrong. I'm just interested in the passages out of which he motivates his problem. And those passages are in Wittgenstein. And just sort of get a sense of what kind of issue is going on there. Not worry for the moment about what is Wittgenstein's ultimate response to that issue. But what's the issue that's in these passages? So that's why I'm purposely truncating our look at Wittgenstein here. I said almost exclusively because in quotation 5, I couldn't help giving you a little bit more than Kripke tends to have us attend to. Just to give you one example of how, if you just read on a little bit in one place, you might start getting very worried about his interpretation. But mostly, as I say, I'm interested in a sense in this particular problem he gets out of Wittgenstein. And what I do want to say about that is that Kripke's right, that Wittgenstein's interested in this problem. I do want to say that. And that might not seem like much of a claim. But actually, in a lot of the secondary literature, After Kripke wrote, at least the secondary literature written by people who are interested in Wittgenstein, a lot of it has the form of their saying, Kripke is completely wrong about Wittgenstein. And they're so concerned to prove he's completely wrong about Wittgenstein, they don't want him to be right about anything. And so in their eagerness to prove he's not right about anything, they don't even want his problem to be a problem Wittgenstein's concerned with. And I think that is, whatever one's reservations might be about Kripke's work, I think that's an overreaction. I think Kripke is doing a pretty lucid job of expounding at least one facet of a problem that comes up in Wittgenstein. What its centrality is, how it relates to other things in Wittgenstein, and what Wittgenstein's response is, those are all other matters. So let's just look at some quotations where this issue comes up. First quotation from section 85 of the investigations, he says, a rule stands there like a signpost. That's a very useful phrase, and it recurs throughout the investigations. There's many references back to this metaphor of the signpost. Sections 87 all the way through into the 400 and 500s. So it's useful to sort of have this motif of the signpost under control. A rule stands there like a signpost. It's connected to a theme in the investigations in which the interlocutor says things like, but the sign itself is dead. I said when the interlocutor says, one thing for those of you who haven't read the investigations much that you'll discover as you read this book is it's full of voices. The interlocutor is a bit misleading. It suggests there's just two people in conversation. Maybe Wittgenstein, this other guy, I don't think that's right. But there are voices. And some and many of the voices are flagged in question marks, in quotation marks, as it were, make explicit there's a voice here that's insisting on something or saying something in response. And one of these voices, recurrently, especially in the 400s on, says something like, the sign itself is dead. And that's connected to the thought that's already coming up here for the first time, in the idea that a rule stands there like a signpost. So you're saying about the nature of rules that might apparently become clear by just thinking about the even simpler case of a signpost. So we have a signpost. Looks like that. Or if this seems to complicate things, because that involves a word, and understanding words is a further feature of understanding rules over and above understanding signs, then maybe we could simplify our example further and just, you know, have a red sign like this. See, this is completely red. And say what I'm trying to do is follow the red trail, going out for a walk in Bergen. And there's a blue trail and a red trail. I've decided to take the red trail. And occasionally there's a sign like this. I actually believe, if I recall correctly, that, is this right? On the way up to Wittgenstein's hut in Scholden, first you get orange W's, but then at some point you just get some orange signs pointing, so you know. I'm trying to follow the orange signs up to the hut. So here I am. So it just has a shape, you know, like that. It's a signpost. Now, a signpost in itself is just a physical object, like any other. There isn't, in principle, any contradiction in the idea that you could have a culture, and in that culture, they use signposts, and a signpost with this shape means go that way. There's no logical contradiction. Wittgenstein says a little later in this passage, I think I left it out, but he says a case like this would be a little bit like a case where you had a culture where somebody pointed, and in that culture, people are inclined to follow the line from finger to wrist out over the shoulder. So you point, they look over there. And indeed, anyone who's ever tried to, say, teach a dog to point, you know, to understand pointing, realize that's not so dumb. You know, if you point, the dog looks up, you know. Usually looks at the finger first, and then he sort of follows the finger up the line. And it's actually a sign of intelligence among dog trainers. It's not the only test, but it's a very good test of the really smart dogs like shepherds and collies and other dogs, whether you can teach them to understand pointing. It's actually very helpful when you're herding sheep, say, to be able to go, Rover, like that, for him to go after that sheep. But if you go, Rover, and they look at your finger, and they follow your finger up, that's not very helpful. You want some way to... and a lot of dogs can't learn this, some dogs can. But similarly, as with pointing, so with signs. There isn't anything about the physical signpost on this picture of meaning. Remember, we were talking about a gap. A gap of something that simply belongs to nature on the one side of the gap. And the other side of the gap, there's something that we think of as mental or intentional. If we think of the signpost as just part of the material world, and there isn't anything that belongs to it that has meaning built into it. And certainly if you take the signpost apart, you know, and use a microscope and break it into little pieces, you won't find its meaning anywhere inside. It's not in that sense a physical property of the signpost. So with the idea within this picture that a signpost just stands there, is it's just this physical object. And with the idea that the signpost just stands there, you might think, what is an understanding? What is it to understand that in order to stay on the orange path, or I guess in this case, the pink path? In order to stay on the pink path, I go this way. Well, very natural thing to think is, that understanding involves, borrowing a phrase, two stages. Now we're not talking about Kantian philosophy of perception. We're not talking about McDonald philosophy of action. But I hope you see a structural parallel. It involves two stages. First, there's the stage of, as it were, taking in the physical sign. That itself just stands there. Instead. Then there has to be a second stage. A natural word we might use here, without having gotten, you know, very elaborate in our theory about what the second stage involves, is the word interpretation. It's only the sign, qua physical entity, combined with an interpretation that yields an understanding of what we are to do in the light of it. Go this way. So we know to interpret the sign means to follow the arrow this way. There might be another culture in which you have things that look just like this, but if you understand the culture, you go this way. I gave you the example of, you know, people in Greece in the larger erstwhile Ottoman Empire who express no like this, facially or gesturally. A good example of this was came home to me when I was in Scotland a couple of days ago. First morning in the hotel. Hotel was on a big main street. I stepped out and almost got killed. Because I, of course, looked the way I thought you're supposed to. There's a line in the middle of the road. My understanding of these arrangements at some deep, unreflective, visceral level is people are driving on the right side. People are driving on the right side, and this thing like this, and there's a crosswalk. That means you look a certain direction to see if a car's coming. In England, everything's set up exactly the same way, except you look in the opposite direction, or you die, or in my case, almost die, your first morning before you realize. Looks the same, only you do everything backwards. Some things are different, like they move the steering wheel over, which is helpful. But if you're just a pedestrian, that clue isn't very salient. Things could be set up like this, but the significance could be reversed. No contradiction there. So a rule, similarly, to say a rule stands there like a signpost is to say, I can give you a rule. But any rule I give you, this is the beginning of the problem now, apparently is in no better situation than the signpost itself. This is within the frame of this problem. So say, I tell you, whenever you see a pink sign with a pointing arrow like that, that means go this way. Go in the direction of the pointing arrow. I could write that out. That's a whole lot of words. That's a rule. But now you've got to understand the rule. Any rule comes in the form of a rule formulation. If it's true that any act of understanding involves the object understood, understood as some sort of shapes or sounds or marks or noises in the world, plus an interpretation, then similarly it looks like one ought to have to say or be able to say about our rule, well, that too is something that's been formulated, but it too could be interpreted in more than one way. So it too must be first interpreted before it itself can guide an interpretation of the signpost. So the rule itself, qua object to be understood, stands there like a signpost. Now, one thing you might want to say at this point, I don't have this in the quotations, an idea that Wittgenstein explores quite a bit. It's connected with what some people call Platonism in philosophy of meaning or philosophy of mathematics. One thing you might say is, well, there's some rules which, if you state them, people just understand them. Boom. Those rules, somehow, when you state those, there's no problem anymore about misinterpretation. They're just somehow transparent or self-intimate. But one question you might have is, if that's true, why do we wait a while to introduce that idea? Why don't we just somehow say, we could do that already here with the signpost? And how does it work? How do signposts just tell us what they mean? You can see how we have a version here of what McDowell called the myth of the given, or a potential version of what McDowell here called the myth of the given. Not in philosophy of perception, though, whereas a mere causal event that was supposed to have sufficient rational structure to be able to justify, that was with respect to how it is that experiences could have content. But here it's a physical entity, which somehow, by merely taking in, is supposed to justify one interpretation rather than another. But in both cases, it can look like you're trying to build into something, which itself, a mere moment or element or transaction in nature, a normative ground for a certain kind of meaning or justification or reason, which it itself cannot deliver, hence myth of the given. Something, one wants something to immediately be given. In this case, an object to be interpreted and its interpretation, which itself is not the kind of thing that can be given, or hence that would be the worry on the mythical conception of the given. You had a question?
I'm just wondering about what rules we're speaking about. That's very important.
Well, this is supposed to be, as we'll see in a moment, absolutely general. It doesn't matter what rules we're talking about. The point is, that there's a kind of problem. Now, I'm trying to put this carefully, a kind of problem you can get into when you're thinking about rules. I don't mean to suggest that Wittgenstein, in the end, is endorsing this conception of what the problem is with rules. I'm just not discussing Wittgenstein's view. I'll just tell you not to make a mystery. I don't think that's what he's doing. But he is discussing the problem because he thinks people get into the problem. And if you get into the problem thinking a certain way, it's going to affect all rules, not just some rules. Any rule that involves understanding, any rule that involves correctness or incorrectness, and that's all rules. The question is, isn't it going to be a problem about them? We'll see this more clearly as we go on. So a rule stands there like a signpost. I was trying to show you how much is actually packed into that way of putting it, drawing on other sections without quoting them all. He asks, does the signpost leave no doubt open about the way I have to go? Does the signpost itself somehow make clear which way I have to go? And it's very tempting to say here, no, signpost itself can't do that. Does it show which direction I am to take when I have passed it? Whether along the road or the footpath or cross country? So imagine I cover the signpost. Here's a road. Here's a footpath. That way there's nothing. There's just a field straight across country. I come to it. Does the signpost itself go left on the footpath? Sorry, right on the footpath. Left on the road. Or perpendicular to the axis of the signpost. Straight into the country. Does the signpost itself show which direction I'm supposed to take? Now you could answer yes or no. If you answer yes, and you're in the grip of this worry, then the question arises, but where is it said which way I am to follow it? Whether in the direction of the finger or the opposite one. So we check this choice. Where does the signpost say, go this way rather than go that way? That seems to be, on this understanding, something more than the signpost. That's an understanding, an interpretation of what the signpost means. And if there were not a single signpost, but a chain of adjacent ones, or of chalk marks on the ground, is there only one way of interpreting it? So once we get into this problem, we think the signpost itself is dead. It doesn't mean anything. It's only signpost plus interpretation that yields an understanding of what we are to do, such that it could be correct or incorrect. Then, once we have that picture, it's very hard to see what you're going to add that helps. Say you point. Which way do I go here? You point. We always say, okay. But your pointing gesture stands there like a signpost. But now, in virtue of what do I know that I'm supposed to go this way around that way? That seems to require a interpretation of the pointing gesture. We'll say, well, okay, let's make it absolutely clear. You know, we don't want this to be unclear. So let's put up several signposts. Let's put up another signpost here. It kind of overlaps this one. This one explains that one. This one makes it clear that what this one means is this. We could add these. This clearly isn't going to help. If you have a problem here, multiplying signposts isn't going to be very helpful. Well, we might try, you know, let's put some arrows in the ground. Here, nice magic marker. Could you draw pink arrows all the way? You know, leave out no bits, you know. Pink arrows at every step. We still have the same problem. So, and this passage then goes into, I've left it out, but it then goes into an issue of doubt. If you've raised a doubt about whether this is meant rather than that, and you take the doubt to arise in the way I've just described, then how are you going to close off the doubt? So put this way so far, this is just something I want to alert you to. We've got something that has, you know, at least initially, the form of a Cartesian problem. How do I know what is meant? I'm trying to find my way. I take it there is such a thing as a signpost meaning something. But I want to know which way to go. And the skeptical worry, notice, is based on a kind of indistinguishability argument. There could be a tribe in which things look just like this. There could be a country called England, in which the roads, you know, were divided just down the middle and the cars look the same. But everybody does everything in the opposite direction or on the opposite side. So how can I tell? How can I be sure? And again, here, with this Cartesian doubt, as with the other one, they're not denying that probably I should go that way or something like that. The issue isn't, you know, you know, if we're betting money, what would be a good idea? The issue is, in virtue of what does my knowledge consist? How could I know that? Well, it doesn't look like I can know it except through an interpretation. And then it looks like an argument can come up, which is exactly the same argument we had in the Cartesian case about perceptions in principle being misleading, but indistinguishable from veridical ones. I could have an interpretation that seems for all the world invited, but it is possible that it's a misinterpretation. If I can't exclude the possibility of misinterpretation, then how could I ever know what the sign means? I might get lucky and follow it out, and it turns out I'm there. More than lucky. But how, in what sense did I know? What would it mean for me to know it? That's a Cartesian issue. But quickly in the investigations, this turns into a worry of a deeper sort. So now, here we had signposts. But the point is not just about signposts, but signs generally. That is, things we take ourselves to be able to understand. Things in the light of which there is a correct and incorrect way of going on. In using the sign again and in acting in accordance with our understanding of the sign. So another simple example is proper names. You know, maybe the simplest kinds of words. Moses. There's the word Moses. It names somebody. How do we know who it names? Well, I could give an explanation of who Moses names. Quotation 2, 87 of the Investigations. I take Moses to mean the man, if there was such a man, who led the Israelites out of Egypt, whatever he was called then, and whatever he may or may not have done besides. He chooses the example of Moses. It's a good example to choose to get this where you're going. It's not absolutely clear he existed. It's not absolutely clear the text is completely reliable. And you might think, well, there is somebody who was born to Pharaoh, who was very important to help the Israelites. But he didn't lead them out of Egypt. Maybe there was somebody who brought some commandments down, but didn't lead them out. Maybe he led them out of Egypt, but there weren't any commandments. You could really start getting worried, especially if you're not some kind of Christian or Jew, that God actually spoke to him through the burning bush. There's a lot of things that happened to Moses. There seems to be somebody we're talking about. Which descriptions, if you think the meaning of a name depends upon some of these descriptions being true, which descriptions are the ones you mean when you say Moses? Somebody says, well, there, you know, he wasn't actually a son. He wasn't actually put in a boat on a river. I won't conclude, oh, Moses didn't exist. I'll conclude, well, that's not, you know, what I mean by Moses isn't someone who's put in a river. I mean this guy, this other guy, who led people out of Egypt, who I thought was also put on a boat. But he's not being put in a boat doesn't keep me from meaning something by Moses. But similar doubts to those about Moses are possible about the words in the explanation. So I say, he's the one who led the Israelites out of Egypt. What do you mean by Israelites? What do you mean by Egypt? Well, by Egypt, I mean a country that has these and these borders. Well, actually, it looks like they start over here. That wasn't Egypt, according to you. Well, back then they called it. So by Egypt, you mean what people called Egypt back then, or what we call Egypt now? We can go on. But any explanation you give of what you mean by the word depends upon your understanding of the words you use in your explanation of what you mean by the word. Those two have to be interpreted. They can be misinterpreted. There can be more than one way of going on from what seems like what you meant to other cases once complicated factors come up. Like the lines have changed or no one was ever put in a boat. Nor would these questions come to an end when we got down to words like red, dark, sweet. But then how does an explanation help me to understand if, after all, it is not the final one? If for any explanation you can give about what you mean by your words, a question can, at least in principle, always arise. You can always think up of a situation in which a question will arise about what you mean by one of the words in the explanation of what you mean by the original word. In that case, the explanation is never completed. So there's a certain picture. You start with the idea the sign itself doesn't have a meaning. We can't understand that. We can only understand it in the light of an interpretation. Excuse me. In the light of an interpretation. This is very sad because I don't actually know how to turn it back on. But I will investigate that matter later.
Would somebody tell me when it's time for a break? I don't have a timepiece now. So it's never the final one. A further misinterpretation can always arise. And then he says at the end of our quotation, in that case, the explanation is never completed. So I still don't understand what he means and never shall. As though an explanation, as it were, hung in the air unless supported by another one. Notice what's happening in the worry here. Initially, it looks like, well, we can't be sure what we mean because our explanations could be wrong. But if what it is to understand what we mean is to know our interpretation is right, and the only way to know our interpretation is right is to at least be able to understand what a formulation of the interpretation expresses, and that itself is something that could be misunderstood. If we start to think this through, there's a worry about what it is we even think understanding consists in. If we think what understanding consists in is understanding this in the light of that, where understanding that thing itself raises the same problem, it looks like we're creating a situation in which it looks like our understanding is always incomplete. Our grounds for a belief that we know what something means aren't insufficient. But nothing could count as there being sufficient. This will become clear as we go on. Now let's skip to much later investigations. Wittgenstein gives a mathematical example. Something I think Kripke says about that mathematical example is exactly right. Which is that the mathematical example is meant to bring out very perspicuously something that's true about understanding generally. The point being raised here isn't sort of a narrow point in philosophy of mathematics. It's a problem for the philosophy of mathematics too, if you will. But it's just meant to be a perspicuous example of the kind of problem we've already been looking at. I think Kripke's quite right about that. Some defenders of Wittgenstein think somehow he needs to be taken for task for saying that, but I don't see why. So the example is a famous one now, thanks to this passage investigations. We have a student, and we're teaching him the rule, add two. Add two is a rule. I write add two, or I say add two. And notice we could say now, I'm getting ahead of the passage, but just to make the connection clear, we could say now, that stands there like a signpost. That is, we've said something. The student's supposed to do something now. Now, in virtue of what can we conclude? What the student has done is correct in light of what we told him to do, the rule. Let's say the student is doing really well. We say add two. Start with two. I'm going to give you a two. We give this problem to Kato. I'm giving you two. Now go to work. I want you to add two. Here goes Kato. Look at him go. He's good at this. He's doing it really fast. Right? He's firing along. He's going to need a big blackboard for this problem. But imagine we have a really big blackboard. Kato's shooting along. Slowing down a bit. His wrist is getting tired. But he's still doing fine. So he's doing great. He's gotten all the way to 1,000. And I'll just let you know, given my understanding of add two, he's done fine. Notice I stuck these dot, dot, dots in here. I'm kind of cheating, because the whole problem is about, what does a dot, dot, dot mean? What is it to convey something by doing a few things and then saying dot, dot, dot? That is really where the essence of our problem. But so pretend I've actually filled a board with numbers, not with dot, dot, dots, because that is a profound cheat. And this entire board contains things that you would be willing to call even numbers. All and only the even numbers between 2 and 1,000. Now, of course, what even numbers mean is something else that you'd have to understand. We'll come back to that, but pretend you understand me for now. So that's what we've got. He's gone this far. I'm very much inclined to say, I really, in a way, made him work awfully hard for this reward. I ought to have been able to stop at 18. But I made him go to 1,000.
And now I'm inclined to say, you know, Kanto really understands the rule ad too. I mean, his performance, I think, is impeccable. I asked him to add two. It took him a couple hours. He wrote 500 numbers on the board. I like all of them. I really like the order in which he did it. I want to say he understood ad two. And I didn't show him these. I never told him what comes between these two. He did that himself. So if we want to say with Wittgenstein, the child or the student understands the rule when he can go on his own, looks like Kato's passed the test. He understands the rule ad two. But just as I'm about to stop, Kanto, I'm saying, you've done beautifully. Stop. You clearly understand it. He writes that. And that sort of freezes me. So now I'm about to say, please stop. You're tired. Hey, Kanto, please stop. You can go, Kanto. And off he goes, you know, like this. You know, now I sort of want to say, Kanto, remember? Two, add two. I said, yeah, I went on the same way. That's what I did. Well, no, look. Right? And then, there's this bigger gap. I mean, you changed what you were doing. And Kanto wants to say, no. I was going on the same way. This is what I was doing from the beginning. I was doing this from the beginning. My understanding of that was such that these are all instances of that. Now, so we say to him, just look at the passage. Look what you've done. He doesn't understand. He says, we say, you were meant to add two. Look how you began the series. He answers, yes, isn't it right? I thought that was how I was meant to do it. Suppose he pointed the series and said, but I went on in the same way. If he really thinks that, he's not just mistaken, but he thinks he's going on in the same way, then it would be no use to say, but can't you see, and repeat the old examples and explanations. In such a case, we might say, perhaps it comes natural to this person to understand our order with our explanations as we should understand the order. Add two up to 1,000, four up to 2,000. That is, there is a function, to put it in sort of mathematical terms, there is a function such that these are all correct instances of the function. These are the outputs of the function in order. This is a way of going on. What you're doing is, as it were, acting in the light of the demand to, as it were, do that. That's an understanding. A possible understanding, just like the signpost, reading it this way around that way, that's a, I think, misunderstanding. I want to say, no, I meant this, he misunderstood it. So an initial Cartesian worry is, how do we know, when someone says this, that he meant this rather than that? But the deeper Kantian worry comes, we start to focus on the fact that, my God, he went all the way to 1,000. But all of those performances, all of those acts themselves, which in a sense are ultimately just physical marks, are consistent with my understanding of what the rule that stands there like a signpost means, and his understanding of what the rule that stands there like a signpost means. And if you think about it carefully, you'll realize we're not going to solve this problem now by going on further. No matter how long we go on, there's more than one function, different functions, that all of those instances could be correct in the light of an understanding of, and yet, what would be the next step would be different. And if you think about the mathematics, in fact, you realize it's more than just more than one function. For any finite number of instances, there's an infinite number of functions such that everything he's done so far would be correct in the light of any of those infinite possible. He might say, some of them are more like, you know, who would ever ask someone to do something this convoluted? But the question right now we're asking is, what does it mean to say that he's grasped this? If no number of instances show that he's grasped this as correct, what is it to grasp this as correct? What is correct mismeaning? If up to any point, there's an infinite number of things we could mean that would be correct, and we can't tell from the instances themselves which of them we do mean. What does acting correctly in the light of the understanding mean? That's the question that's starting to float up here.
Should we take a break?
Is that time?
5 past 7.
Boy, I'm not going very fast, am I? Have a break. See you in 10 minutes. What about Kripke?